I have
current geek.
Hello, everyone. Welcome back to Current Geek. This is the autopilot edition of the show, a chance for us to watch a pilot episode of a TV show and geek out about it. I'm Scott Johnson. He's Tom Merritt. This week, we are talking about Cheers.
Man. Okay, so I know this has happened to you a few times when we've done an autopilot.
Yeah.
But I have got sucked into the Cheers watching.
Are you surprised by this? Like,
I've watched 12 episodes of this show.
Oh, my gosh. All right. So you're halfway through the first season now. And that's impressive. Yeah, I do this a lot, but I didn't do it this well. I shouldn't say that. Cheers is kind of permanently on in this house. It feels like my kids love it. Okay. Kim loves it, so it's always kind of on.
Low level background Cheers just going on at all times.
Yeah, a little bit of Frasier here and there because we led from our last viewing of Cheers led to a Frasier rewatch. So I think that's going on right now. But yeah, like I don't blame you. It's a good show. It's still good, right?
I'm shocked how well it held up for me. I don't know if it's just because of my age or what, but I don't think I had seen an episode in a long time. So that's probably part of it, right? I'm not, you know, it's not like, oh yeah, Friends I've seen recently, whatever, but Cheers, I'm like, man, I haven't seen this in a long time. Also, 1982, it was a year that I remember as being like enjoying culture. Like some of my favorite albums came out, television shows, et cetera. And I was way into Cheers from the beginning, from the first Thursday airing on NBC. I thought it was great. I remember being worried it was going to get canceled because it had horrible ratings its first season. And I remember being in college, like I was 12 years old when it premiered. When did it premiere exactly? September 30th, 1982, mm-hmm. October 14th in Alaska for some reason. I remember that by the time I was in college, I guess I was just out of college when Cheers had its final episode, and realizing that I'd caught episodes here and there over the years, but I kind of got out of the habit of watching it all the time, and sitting down to watch that final episode and see Sam turn out the lights. It was emotional. Like, this show meant a lot to me when it was on the air. So maybe some of that's colored by that sentimentality, but I haven't thought about it a lot. I haven't really had it in my mind. I don't own a box set of it. I hadn't sought it out to watch. So maybe it just kind of hit me with a ton of bricks because of that. But it feels like it's not trying to make jokes that are 1982 specific. Mm-hmm. Because you have Diane, who's a feminist character, you know, some of the 80s humor that could feel pretty out of place and dated gets challenged within the context of the show. Mm-hmm. So that makes it feel kind of more modern sometimes. And it's just, I don't know. It's such a lovely way to spend 25 minutes. Maybe that's part of it too, is it's only 25 minutes.
I couldn't agree more. I don't know what it is either. And I also don't think it's just pure nostalgia or pure sentimentality, because what usually will happen when you have that feeling is you'll get back to it and you'll be reminded that it's very dated, or it will not hold up, as we're all fond of saying, does it hold up or not? I think that happens a lot of things. It doesn't happen here, and I have a theory about that. I think that Cheers persists and is still great for one key and chief reason. It focuses on characters and their development and not on tropes of the day. For example, I don't think a show like Big Bang Theory will have this lasting power in 30 years.
Right, because it's so focused on the cultural memes of our time.
Correct.
Right?
And I think that's it's not necessarily a mistake. It's fine to do that with your show. But
if you're
talking about longevity or things that still resonate with people, I think the reason that does is the same reason. I have a daughter who loves the Dick Van Dyke Show from the 60s. She's 22. She's nowhere near the generation that would have most entertained, but because that show's about character and not so much about stuff of their time, and you can't help but have some stuff of the time, that's always going to be true. Even the look of it,
every time they name a Red Sox player in Cheers, I'm suddenly like, whoa, Dostremski was still playing when the show was on the air. Okay, crazy. Yeah.
Right, like that kind of stuff. Notwithstanding, it is all about Sam and Diane and later Woody and now Coach and Norm and Cliff and everybody as they started to become these characters, and they developed them over time. that's why I think that show lasted so long. And I also think it's why it never really felt like it jumped the shark. I think a lot of shows lose mm-hmm. their luster, lose their ability to continue to hold me. I would actually throw out Frasier as an example of this. Frasier was great until the final couple of seasons when they let one of its core things fall apart, which was this tension between Niles and Daphne. They decided to have them get together. And I think that was a huge mistake. Right. And you could say, well didn't Cheers do that? But Cheers did it so deftly with these relationships that it never felt like they were jumping sharks or retreading old jokes. It always felt fresh, and that's hard to do.
Yeah, there's something complex about this simple premise, right? And that sunk into me. I've watched 12 episodes of it now, and so some of this is not coming from the pilot. I apologize for violating the spirit of autopilot, but I have to say that I remember, and the culture remembers, the Sam and Diane will they won't they mm-hmm. much more as being much more important and centered than it actually is.
Yeah,
it's very clear in this first season that Sam and Diane, Sam kind of, he's a ladies man, right? So mm-hmm. he will sort of pursue anyone that moves within a certain set of parameters. But he's also not serious about liking Diane. And Diane is not serious about liking Sam in any potential way. Like that is very much an undercurrent of attraction.
Right.
And it's very plausible given these first few episodes that they wouldn't get together, that there's somewhat of an intrigue between them. And I think that's why it works when Diane finally does leave the show, that you can continue to have Cheers happen, because while Sam and Diane was a very interesting story, and obviously the premise in this pilot episode is that Diane gets, ditched by this professor and ends up working in the bar because she just couldn't face going back to being a teaching assistant for that professor. And yeah, I guess that it's a little bit far-fetched that you would take a bar job in Beacon Hill. But it gets the premise going. Other than that, you have so much else going on. You have Coach and his relationship with Sam, because they used to be in baseball together and they're both out of baseball. You have Norm and his escaping his family life. You don't have much depth to the other bar patrons, even Cliff. Cliff's just the know-it-all.
Sure.
He'll get more story later, but you're it's about Carla with the kids and all of that. Like it's really about the family of the bar, mm-hmm. and that sort of that idea of your family of choice versus your family of birth. And I think that's one of the reasons that it ends up surviving its horrible ratings in the first season and becomes a critically acclaimed multiple Emmy winning show that lasted for 11 years.
Well, you could argue that the reason that it that the show would go on to be such an important Hallmark show is because not only did they give it a chance, but also that stuff takes time. This character stuff I'm talking about is not something you do. You don't just grab a trend or a fad and go, boom, here it is. Ha ha ha. You have to build that over time. And I think that was true. I mean, there are a lot of shows from that era that were tanking in their first season. Seinfeld was a great example too, although that was late 80s, early 90s. But that was another show that had horrible ratings for its first season, and certainly for a first chunk of episodes,
and was very character driven, right?
Very. Like
it's a show about nothing. It says it right there on the tin.
Right. And they got this close to getting canceled multiple times. Like I really admire, I think that must see Thursday thing kind of came out of NBC being willing to let stuff hang around a bit longer than the ratings would suggest. And they don't really do that anymore. Network television's not real great at that anymore. It's a different world now, and who could even speculate what Cheers is like in 2019? But
it's interesting because Netflix and Prime Video and Hulu are better at that sort of thing now.
Right.
The conventional wisdom these days is that Netflix will give anything two seasons, and if it's doing halfway decent, three. But after that, it has to prove itself or it's done.
The other thing I like about it is that the bar itself, I like when a show can do this. The bar itself to me is a character. It is so recognizable for what it is, the tone of it, the color of it, the stuff hanging everywhere, the way that thing's just arranged is so burned into my head as this place that really matters. And that's why I think the final episode was so gut-wrenching at the time. I remember being really affected by it because it was down again, back again to this thing that started the show. The original pilot is just Sam in this empty bar. And now it's Sam leaving that same empty bar and leaving it for good, and the lights going out on what is arguably the most important character there, which is this structure and place that brings all these characters together. And I still get just a little tiny bit weepy about it. Like, to me, that's the sign of a successfully a successful core to what your project is. If you want to make a show that people care about, the core needs to be grounded and anchored in something important. And that bar felt important, not just for the humor, but for some of the drama, but for all of those characters to kind of have this thing that they could sort of, you know, come to and be at and be among friends and all of those things. It's really good. Like, it's really good. And like I say, I don't think there are very few modern TV show examples I can think of that will have that kind of longevity or that kind of, hey, it holds up in 30 years effect.
Man, you're so right about the bar too. I mean, consider the fact that, yeah, we've got a MASH tent in the Smithsonian, right? Our Archie Bunker's chair is in a museum. I think it's also the Smithsonian. The Cheers exterior was of the Bull and Finch in Beacon Hill in Boston. Because of Cheers, the Bull and Finch changed its name to Cheers Boston or Cheers Beacon Hill.
I didn't know that.
The interior of the Bull and Finch never looked like the interior very much anyway, that was used on the set of Cheers, but the exterior shots were all real. It's kind of an event, like a private event club upstairs. So there was never a Melville's Fine Seafood, and there still isn't, but I think it's the Hampshire House or something like that is the place where you can have a wedding reception or whatever above where Cheers Boston, like it ended up changing its name to Cheers Boston and opened a second location in another part of Boston that is a replica of the inside of Cheers from the television show.
Yeah.
Like, that bar was such a character that it changed the original bar it was based off of into itself and replicated a version that looked more like itself.
Yeah, it's so cool. And also, this is a little known fact and brings back Frasier again, but people always ask, well, why didn't Frasier ever go back to visit the bar? Why was that never a story? They had a lot of people from Cheers show up in episodes in Frasier, but they would come Seattle.
Everyone but Rebecca.
Everybody but Rebecca, you're right.
Well, I'd coach, obviously.
But, oh, yeah, because he passed away. But yeah, they had everybody come at some point or another that could or would, and he would never go back. And I found out, I don't know if this is the reason why they would never want to rebuild it, but the set they use for the coffee shop and it wraps around to his apartment and pretty much all the notable places that you go to in Frasier's world is the same set, not the same set, but the same space. So all that stuff, all that Cheers stuff was taken out and they built the Frasier sets and then did that for 10 years. And something about that, now every time I watch a Frasier episode, I think about it. I think about that bar was there. Like that corner likely was the corner where they'd head off into the pool room / bathroom hall thing. That over there is probably where it led upstairs to Melville's. Or like I had all of these, like I have all of this visual in my head. So when I watched Frasier now, that's all I can think about. But apparently all his stuff sat on that same, I would argue, historic spot that they filmed all of Cheers on, which is really cool. So James Burrows, who produced the show and directed this episode, we know that guy from a million successful things. He did Taxi before this. He would go on to be a producer on Frasier. He was a producer on Will and Grace, directed a bunch of those episodes as well. Like, that guy was all over TV for a long, long, long time. Friends, Darman Greg, Caroline in the City. Like, think of an 80s, 90s comic or a sitcom, and your buddy James Burrows was driving that car.
He was a huge director. He met the guys, what's their names, Glenn and Les Charles. Working on Taxi,
right?
Because he directed a bunch of episodes of Taxi, and then I don't know, Burrows ended up directing almost all of Cheers. I think he directed all but 35 of the 275 episodes.
Oh my gosh, that's crazy. He was also executive producer on 226 episodes and And from 82 to 84, some of the early ones he was on those as well. But the 84 to 93 stuff is where he really stepped in. But that guy was just prolific. He was everywhere. And you started to see him in all these other shows that came out of that. I don't know what he's up to now. I think I've seen his name on The Simpsons a few times. Want to say there was some other stuff in between there that I really like. But one of the most storied careers, if you go look at that guy's IMDb page, it's insane. Insane how much work that guy did. Just crazy. And this was early in his career. This would have been like, I don't know, what was this? Well, you said 82 to, what, 93? Was that the total 82 run?
82 to 93, yeah.
Yeah, and he was heavily, heavily involved in that. He also did the do you remember the Tortellis that lasted like a hot minute?
Yeah, I think, so it's interesting. That reminds me, John Ratzenberger, yeah. I'm going to be a Cliff Clavin about Cliff Clavin right now.
Go for it.
First of all, wasn't a character in Cheers. In fact, Norm wasn't a character in Cheers originally, but they by the time they were doing auditions, they had created a barfly character. That was Norm. John Ratzenberger auditioned for Norm, but didn't get the part. They gave it to George Wendt. And Ratzenberg pitched the idea that they should have a know-it-all barfly. Mm. Because every bar has the one person who just spouts off trivia. And so the Burroughs were like, yeah, all right, let's do that. I guess the Charles.
The brothers, Charles. Not, they have weird names. It's hard to keep.
There's them. Only one Burroughs. There's yeah. two Charles. The brothers said, yeah, let's do that. At first, they were going to make him a security guard because it was kind of loosely based on an actual character who was a policeman. And then they decided that a postman just felt like somebody people could identify with more. And so that's how Cliff became a postal carrier. He was not a regular. He's credited in the post credits, you know, with, you know, special guest John Ratzenberger for the first season. He's in all but one of the episodes of Cheers, though. Like, mm-hmm. Hell of a thing to pitch a character after not getting an audition, have that character become Cliff Clavin. And Ratzenberger ended up, I don't know if he set a record or tied a record for playing a character, like the same character, in the most franchises, because he shows up in the Tortellis and in Frasier and in Wings and in St. Elsewhere.
Oh, I didn't know that. Cliff Clavin is in St. Elsewhere?
I believe. I'm looking for my citation on that. I know there's a St. Elsewhere crossover, and I think
That's amazing if that's true. I loved St. Elsewhere too, but I didn't know they occupy the same universe. That's insane. Holy crap. All right, yeah, I didn't know all about all those records. Here's the thing. Like, that's a crazy story. I didn't know any about that stuff about him, but Cliff
is... I'm double-checking the St. Elsewhere part of that right now, because he played Cliff Clavin in the Earth Day special.
Okay.
He played Cliff Clavin in Mickey's 60th Birthday, Walt Disney's Wonderful World of Color, the Tortellis, and yeah, he played Cliff Clavin in St. Elsewhere in the episode called Cheers.
That's amazing. All right, now I gotta go watch. I gotta go find that. I would argue that he is one of the greatest sitcom side characters in the history of sitcoms. It's really funny. He's very funny, and he sets up so much funny stuff. There's a whole episode that's way down the line, but there's an episode where he wears a dog shock collar for the whole episode, because nobody wants him to spout off facts anymore. And the only way to get him to stop going, well, you know, like that whole thing, that well, actually thing, the way they stop
him. You
know,
Sammy.
they put a dog collar on him and then just keep zapping him every time he says something. It's very funny. But he is one of the greatest. And I don't know that we'd have him as that bit part he always is in those Pixar movies if it wasn't for the success of Cheers. Like way to go, John Ratzenberger. Like, that is a huge... That's a huge thing for him, and that's awesome. But that's interesting about what you said about side characters in the beginning. He would have been considered sort of a not main player for a while, and then eventually made it in the credits and all of that. But
he was in all but one episode.
But he was in
fact,
all of them, yeah.
When Coach died, when John Nick Colasanto died, he was the one member of the cast that was allowed to go to the funeral because they were shooting. And they were like, we can't spare everybody going out there. So they nominated John Ratzenberger to go out to the funeral and represent the cast.
Is that why he wasn't on some episode?
You know, I don't know. I was trying to track down which episode he wasn't in and try to you know, triangulate that and see. But I never did figure that out. Coach dying, though, which they wrote into the story when Nicola Santo died, they just wrote in that Coach died. Mm-hmm. Devastated me. I mean, more than Diane leaving, mm-hmm. Coach was my favorite on that show.
Oh,
he
yeah.
still is.
Still like, is watching mine too. Yeah. He's great.
I have entertained forever. I want him to just be my friend. And so when he was gone, I was like, I don't know if they can replace Coach. And they replaced him with Woody Harrelson, who at first I was like, well, that sounds like they're just trying to make a young Coach. But Woody Harrelson, as we all know now, is so good that it only took me a few episodes to warm up, and Woody became a favorite of
yeah,
mine.
Yeah, no,
well.
It totally worked. Like it's a miracle that it worked, but it worked.
Yeah,
yeah, it shouldn't have worked.
And,
like just like
and, according to the story, yeah. The character was named Woody Boyd before they started auditions, and then they cast Woody Harrelson.
I love
and
that.
It was just coincidence.
Yeah, it's a small miracle that worked at all. But what I liked about the Coach character was the show very, I think, deftly skirted this idea that they were having fun at the expense of somebody who is perhaps in declining mental capacity. Okay, he's old, doesn't know a lot of stuff, and they didn't play. They didn't. How do I put this? They got that part right. Like they didn't lay on it like it was some horrible thing or that it was a problem or make fun of somebody that might be in the throes of some sort of dementia and or memory loss or whatever. Instead, you were just kind of always felt like this cuddly old guy is just kind of dense and always has been. And it's lovable and you can't do nothing but love him. Like there was never I never felt like there was anything mean thrown his direction. And that's hard to do. I like how they wrote that.
Yeah, well, I think Coach is based on Yogi Berra, right? Mm-hmm. Yogi Berra famously has all those sayings, you know, it's never over till it's over, and nobody goes there, it's too crowded, and, right. you know, all those kinds of sayings. And I think because you get the idea that Coach has always been that way, right? Mm-hmm. Maybe it's gotten a little worse as he's getting older, but that's just like Sam never looks at him pitifully like, ah, oh, Coach, you're getting old. Sam just nods his head like, yeah, that's Coach. That's, you know, that's how he has always been. Right.
Yeah. Yeah. I liked how they handled that.
In one of those early episodes, I don't think it's in the pilot. It's later. He talks about how he specialized in getting hit by pitches.
And then that maybe is always a little dense. I like that. That's pretty good.
He makes Diane throw a ball at him.
Yeah.
And she's like, well, there's no way I'm going to hit him. And then she hits him and she's freaked out.
Yeah.
But yeah, you get the idea of like, okay, Coach, it's not because he's old. You know, I'm sure that's aggravating it, but I think that helps them handle it. And he's just hilarious.
It was definitely my first experience of television loss growing up. Like you would have shows that you're into, but people would leave shows or their characters would die on shows, but you knew that they were still out there moving on to their next project. Like Diane, you didn't, you know.
Yeah, right.
Sad for a different kind of reason. But when you heard that the actor died and you knew they were going to write him out of the show as a death, there was something really striking about that. And I really had a hard time with it. Like it was not, I remember being at school and just thinking about it. Thinking about Coach.
I feel like it was right up there. It's in my head anyway, with Mr. Hooper dying.
Oh, right. I forgot about Mr. Hooper. That was also a big one.
Because it's a similar, Mr. Hooper was, you know, much smarter man than Coach's character.
Right.
But, you know, similar age, similar belovedness. And both of them actually, you know, the actors died and then they just dealt with that directly. You know, much more of a different impact when you're dealing on a children's show like Sesame Street. But, mm-hmm. but yeah, I think Mr. Hooper dying in some ways prepared me for Coach dying.
That's interesting. He died in 82, so it would have been right on time for
yeah
for all of that. In my head, I have those separated by a huge bunch of time, but obviously it was all roughly the same time.
Time's longer when you're young, right?
I do remember my parents freaking me out, telling me when Hooper died, they told me that he had been on Sesame Street for almost as long as I'd been alive. I said, what do you mean? They said his birthday his first appearance day on Sesame Street was the year you were born. It was about 6 months after you were born. I think October, November, or something like that. He showed up on the show for the first time, and so he's been there as long as you've been watching it, is what they used to tell me. And I remember that was kind of a big deal. But anyway, yeah, Coach, like, how do you replace that guy? And they figured it out. I don't know how they did it. I still, to this day, think it's one of the greatest achievements in television history. And you can say, oh, Woody Harrelson's that good. Okay, great. But there's more to it than that. It's how they wrote it.
Yeah, they didn't know
that
at the time. Yeah. I mean, that certainly helped, but yeah.
That should have been bad. That should have made us all go, well, how is this show going to go on, or can I ever like it as much? And you could argue that that was the moment the show proved itself. It's like it could do this.
Well, the thing they did wrong, or should have done wrong, was making Woody kind of dim, mm-hmm. like Coach. Mm-hmm. Like, that shouldn't have worked.
Right. That should have made
been
us
just
all...
like, oh, come on, it's just not as good,
yeah,
right?
Yeah.
But maybe it is attributing in part to Woody Harrelson, but I think it's also attributed to the Charles writers. They made it different. You know, they were able to have the same jokes in a different way. And I think it was smart to cast him as a young man versus an old man. If you'd cast another dim old man, it would have looked bad for sure.
Did you ever watch that Tortelli spinoff? Did you ever catch that?
Yeah, I did back when it was on, because I was such a huge fan of Cheers. I remember almost nothing about it, though.
Yeah, so the story was Carla's husband, Nick Tortelli, who was played by I can't remember the actor's name, but you know him from a million things. He's great. I forgot his name. But anyway, he and his blonde sort of Barbie wife started their own, or had their own little spinoff, and it was going to be about them and their lives. And it was, I thought, freaking funny. Like, I thought it was really funny. It just could not claw itself a space in the ratings, and it just never worked out. And so I thought at the time, like, well, that's it for spinoffs from Cheers. This will never produce anything else. You know, it's just too good. Anything that pops out of Cheers just can't compete. And then along came Frasier.
Dan Hedaya,
that's the guy.
Yeah.
He's great. He's in I
think one of the reasons it didn't work is Nick Tortelli, to me as a Cheers fan, was only important in relation to Carla. Mm-hmm. And when Carla wasn't on the Tortellis, except as an occasional guest star, I'm like, man, I don't really care about this family.
Yeah.
I'm sorry.
I think that's it. But then Frasier breaks that mold, doesn't it? Because you could argue that they're going to do a spinoff about the psychiatrist that dated Diane for a while.
I thought that at the time. I'm like, this is going to be another Tortellis. But Frasier was a stronger character than Nick Tortelli.
Yeah, I agree. It's also, you know, the idea of moving him to another state and then really good writing. Like, those guys knew what they were doing. This is like the same crew. They kind of all moved on and did this. And it's not like they were, they had some experience with this, so they knew what to do with the guy. But it is still an impressive thing when a show gets a spinoff that's as successful, wins as many awards and that sort of stuff as the originating show. Just rarely happens otherwise. Can't think of one, actually.
I want to talk a little bit about
Jefferson's.
Thursday.
That's a good one.
You mentioned the must-see Thursday thing. I went and looked up the TV schedules.
Yeah.
So the year before Cheers premiered, so in 1981, Thursday night on NBC was Fame, Different Strokes, Gimme a Break, and Hill Street Blues.
Mm-hmm.
Different Strokes and Gimme a Break, pretty solid comedies, but you've got dramas on the other side.
Mm-hmm.
Then Cheers comes in and... for part of the season, it's in front of Taxi, which is later in its life and got moved to Thursday. So you got Fame, Cheers, Taxi, and Hill Street Blues. For part of the year, it's Gimme a Break on Thursday with Cheers after it.
Right.
And that's when Cheers doesn't do well, right? It starts off in the 9 o'clock slot leading into Taxi coming out of Fame. It's not doing great. So they put Gimme a Break back on Thursday to lead into Cheers. It didn't really help, but they're sticking with it. In 1983, now we start to see Must See Thursday starting to take shape, because Gimme a Break moves to 8 o'clock.
Mm-hmm.
Then you've got either Mama's Family in the fall or Family Ties as a midseason replacement, followed by either We Got It Made in the fall or Cheers at 9, although Cheers was at 9:30 in the fall, followed by Buffalo Bill, The Duck Factory, or finally Night Court. So by the end of this year, you've got Gimme a Break, Family Ties, Cheers, Night Court, and you still got Hill Street Blues.
Mm-hmm.
And then it's 1984 when Cheers finally solidifies the lineup that I think everybody thinks of as the classic must-see Thursday, which is the Cosby Show, Family Ties, Cheers, and Night Court.
Yeah, that is your classic lineup. And then Hill Street Blues after. Like, your big drama after all your
Hill
comedies.
Hill Street Blues was still there at 10 until it died.
For a while there, yeah. But the but that, like, L.A. Law kind of took that spot. And then, I don't remember what was after that. ER, I guess, in the later years. But I always remember, in fact, I remember ER being kind of prime time because that was during the Friends and Seinfeld reign. And so you had Friends, I think Suddenly Susan or something. And then or maybe Wings after that. Then you had Seinfeld, I think Caroline in the City, and then ER. Like, to me, that is also a high point, even though Cosby's out of there. But, you know, that's kind of where that stuff went. And I don't know, you could argue that they had a pretty good run in the 2006-2007 era. You had My Name is Earl, The Office, Scrubs, 30 Rock, and ER.
Yeah.
Like, they did a good job for a long time. But today, there's nothing. What is there? There's
good
nothing.
Good Place.
Good Place. That's it. What else? Some show I don't know. Superstore. Don't know what that is.
Oh, right. It's actually a pretty popular show.
Perfect Harmony. I'm sure these are fine. But it feels like that was just a bygone thing. And it was such a big deal in our youth, in particular you and I growing up as young preteens and then teens. Yeah, Thursday nights on NBC, that was where you watched TV. That was most of where your TV time was spent. And
it's funny is in 1982 when Cheers premiered, it was up against Too Close for Comfort, Simon and Simon. these are shows that people remember. Mm-hmm. By 1984, Cheers is up against Glitter and Eye to Eye or the ABC Thursday Night Movie.
Yeah, pretty much in a dominant position at that point.
Yeah, Simon and Simon was still on too, but
sure.
Yeah.
I also just like, this is a side note, and I don't know, this is hard to quantify, but I like the style of comedy that they were, and I don't mean the content, I mean they were filmed, not video, not crappy.
Before a live studio
Well,
audience.
That's true, but with that, oh, and the pilot doesn't have it. It's the one episode that doesn't have the film before a live studio audience announcement.
Cheers
at the beginning.
Was filmed before a live studio audience.
Yeah, but they filmed everything, so everything looked really high quality and movie-like, you know, lighting and 24-frame film, not the garbage stuff you would get out of, well, I'd argue Family Ties, Cosby Show, Different Strokes. All of those used video, like videotape, and it looked, in my opinion, bad, and I couldn't take those shows seriously. But along comes Cheers, and they film it, like film, actual 35 millimeter film. And there's some huge difference for me when that happens. And Wings did that also. And Seinfeld filmed that way also. Like, all of these guys filmed their show instead of this, what felt like low rent, kind of, I don't know, Baker era Doctor Who quality video.
Well, what's funny is videotape has higher resolution. Like,
it
by
does.
By all on paper measurements, videotape is superior to film.
Right.
But we, I think, have just taught ourselves as a society to prefer film.
Right.
Because videotape looks more realistic. Maybe that's why. It's like, nah, that just looks like something I taped myself.
That's
right?
Exactly right. I think that's exactly it. And I don't know. I can't really put my finger on it, but there's also arguments about frame rates even today. Digital versus film or footage.
24p, man. 24p forever.
Right. There's something about that frame rate combined with the warm tones that film gives you.
They actually, because of the poor ratings, Paramount and NBC, and if you're wondering, Paramount produced it for NBC, which is why CBS, which eventually got all of Paramount's television productions, owns Cheers now. So if you watch it on Hulu, you see the little CBS logo down there. If you're like, wait, I thought it was an NBC show, that's why. But Paramount and NBC asked them to use videotape to save money. They resisted it, but they did a test taping, and the test taping looked so bad that they're like, yeah, fine, just keep doing film.
Keep doing film, yeah. It's expensive. And I also, that's the other thing, you could see why these shows would use video, because it was, like you said, so much cheaper to do it. I mean, we actually live in a bit of a golden age now, because it doesn't matter what you're doing. You're going to go digital, but digital can fake it. It's not like it used to be with videotape, that where it was a clear difference. Like, you can, video cameras now, or sorry, digital, the highest end digital cameras now can make everything look as filmy as you want or as high frame rate video-y as you want. And you don't have to worry about it anymore. So you can film something like Big Bang Theory and do it with digital, and it still looks like film. Back then, they didn't have that option. So I always just liked that they went the extra mile. And to me, I just could take it more seriously. Like, I just could feel like I was, I don't know, it felt more organic and real, even though you're right, it's faker. But there's something more real about it in my head, right? If we had all been raised on video, maybe I'd feel different. But something with that. That always stuck out for me. Anyway, cheers. What else?
The theme song.
Oh, yeah. You got to talk about that.
Where Everybody Knows Your Name by Gary Portnoy. Very interesting that Gary Portnoy brought in to write the song. And instead of getting someone else to record it, they ended up getting Gary Portnoy to write it. He actually wrote it with a woman named Judy Hart. They combined on it. They originally gave a song called People Like Us that they had written to the producers, and the producers loved it. But it was written originally for a musical named Preppies. And even though Preppies wasn't a big hit, Preppies owned the rights to it. And they're like, well, we don't want to try to buy out the rights to it. Give us something else. So if you go on Apple Music, you can look for Gary Portnoy's original Cheers theme EP. And it's got five versions. There's the People Like Us demo, if you want to hear what that sounded like. Mm-hmm. Well, that almost became the theme, but then they didn't want to worry about getting the rights. So then he wrote a version of People Like Us called My Kind of People. They were like, nah, it's not as good as the real thing. He wrote one called Another Day, which talked about like sometimes taking the long way home is better. And they're like, yeah, we kind of like that sentiment. But the third one, of course, was Where Everybody Knows Your Name. And that's the one they ended up saying, we like that. But he had to rewrite the beginning. Mm. So if you go to Apple Music and look it up, there's the Cheers theme original demo, which has the original opening lines. And then he has a full length recording of the one you've come to know from the show, which starts out making the way in the world today takes everything you got. That wasn't the original lyrics, though.
I did not know that.
So yeah.
If I search for...
I don't know if I can play it because we're streaming on Twitch and I don't want to get Scott in trouble. But the original lyrics were singing the blues when the Red Sox lose. It's a crisis in your life. On the run because all your girlfriends want to be your life. And the laundry tickets in the wash.
Oh my gosh.
Wouldn't you like to get away? Sometimes you want to go. And it goes into the one you're not.
That's really weird. Oh my gosh, there's a whole short album of this. So they got People Like Us.
Yep. It's an EP on Apple Music.
Then they got My Kind of People, which was another one.
The first attempt to make a royalty-free version.
Then something called Another Day.
That's the one with the, like, taking the long way home sometimes is the best, which they like the sentiment of. They just didn't think the song was quite right.
Yeah. And then they did Cheers theme, Gary Portnoy's original demo. So that's the demo you're talking about.
That's the one that starts out singing the blues when the Red Sox lose.
Oh,
it's
I got to play this.
In your life.
I don't care if I get in trouble.
And they thought it was too specific. They're like, that won't appeal to a mass audience. So they asked him to change it. But are you going to play it?
Yeah, I'm going to play this bit.
It's a crisis in your life.
What?
On the run because all your girlfriends want to be your wife.
That's weird to hear it that way.
Yeah.
Weird. Okay, but then
that's the original.
Yeah. Let me hear this People Like Us bit.
People like us never need to be told savoir faire and a tan gets you by.
That's so different.
That was the one from Preppies the musical that they're like, yeah, we like it, but we don't want to have to buy rights for it.
That is just crazy. Okay. I was so much more going on with the Cheers theme than I thought. But man, if that isn't like a cozy warm fire at home in the wintertime, you know what I mean? Hearing that music, even in the pilot, I was just like, oh, right. I feel safe here. I feel less worried here. Like there's something about that theme song, man. Just get you.
And it's funny to look back on how it happened because it seems so perfect as it is, right?
Yeah.
And even when you listen to that demo, that's the same music, but with those different lyrics at the beginning, you're like, what is that?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, singing the blues when the Red Sox lose, perfectly appropriate to the Cheers gestalt, right? Because they're all Bostonians and they're all talking about sports in the bar and all that.
Yeah.
I think the Charleses made a correct call, which is like, we love the soaring, wouldn't you like to get away where everybody knows your name part. We just need to open a little more widely appealing. Yeah. And so then Portnoy ends up making your way in the world today, takes everything he got, which is like iconic now.
It's so good. I love that you dug all that up. He also did the Punky Brewster theme, just for people's information. I looked it up.
Oh, yeah, that's right.
It's the only other TV theme I can find that he did. Everything else is like regular albums. He had the fairly popular one in 04 even.
He actually left music for most of the 90s and 2000s and then came back, I don't know, 6 or 7 years ago. Started making new music.
First album on the comeback looks like 04. And then a bunch of other stuff since. His latest is called Pushing 60, which was in 2017. He's got,
assume means he's 59.
I would assume so, yeah. He's got a version on the 04 album called Keeper. The album is called Keeper. And he has a version of the Where Everybody Knows Your Name Cheers theme. And I wonder if this is a weird arrangement. I'm just going to try and see what we get here. Let me skip ahead.
Wouldn't you like to get away?
Yeah, it's like a... That's, you know, interesting.
It's probably one of those things where he gets more of the royalties if he re-performs it and re-records it.
Probably.
The weird way the music business works.
Must be. Wow, that's really great. Yeah, I think this is one of those I'm going to just keep going with for, I don't know, this is probably my 10th viewing of the show, it feels like. I really like it, and I think it's great that you are continuing on with it as well. Like, it's such a perfect thing to have on kind of in the background. You don't really have to...
It's just
super
comfy.
Focused on
like
it.
You, like, yeah. Like you were describing the theme song. The whole show is just like, here's friends, you know, just hanging out. It's like hanging out at a coffee shop or bar, or, you know, it's like hanging out with friends. Like that's sort of what television aspired to try to be in the 80s. And Cheers may have been the best at it.
I agree. It's funny that we're doing that because you're talking about how they're friends, the original friends in a comedy. Next month, the autopilot episode is going to be Friends, the actual thing called Friends. And that pilot, if my memory serves, is weird compared to the rest of the series.
Yeah, I think that's a great point, because this pilot episode of Cheers, even though Diane isn't working at the bar yet, in all other ways feels like everything is fully formed.
Yep.
There's like they hadn't really figured out Coach's role yet, or like, oh, Sam, he's not quite Sam. You know, a lot of times in pilots, you get that. In this pilot, everything felt note perfect, right down to Norm and Cliff. Like Cliff isn't even officially a part of the show yet. And everything is like perfect. Everything is there right from the beginning.
Very consistent. You don't have to jump to episode 2 and go, oh, they changed the theme. Sam's hair is different. The bar got rearranged. Like, none of that stuff happens. It's as if we popped in, we saw what's going on in the bar, and it just took us through for the next 10 years or whatever. And it's just an awesome thing. And also, you know what? I normally hate comedies that try to tackle serious moments. I really do hate that. Cheers always gets a pass on that, though, from me. They do it right.
Handles it so carefully. Right. Like right from the beginning, you've got an alcoholic, a recovering alcoholic running the bar.
Right. Right.
And they do what you should do, which is like, yeah, that's won't be a problem if, you know, but then there's an episode not that far down the road where Sam has a lucky bottle cap that he lends to a Red Sox pitcher to get him good luck. And he can't get it back because the Red Sox pitcher lost it. And it turns out that the bottle cap was the bottle cap of the last drink he ever took.
Right.
And it's been the thing he's been holding, and it works so well. And you're like, man, this isn't funny.
No, but it works. They make it work. Yeah. I don't know how they do that. I can't stand that in most comedies, just hate it. But in here it works. Like anytime somebody says on a very special blossom or something, I'm like, no, nope, we're done. I'm out. Never going to watch that again. But this, they could do it, and it always felt honest. Like they'd get there honestly, and I just think it deserves a ton of respect. So if you've never seen Cheers, it's on 3 streaming services, the big 3. You can get it on Prime, Netflix, and Hulu. All of them have it, which I don't know how that worked out.
Yeah, that's what CBS does, where they're like, yeah, we're going to have stuff on CBS All Access, but our library stuff, we'll also rent it out to anybody. We don't, that old stuff doesn't have to be exclusive. So.
And that's another one of those, you talked about this before, one of those examples of the production company is it's a CBS property, but it aired on a
Paramount property.
Oh, right, right, right.
But when they split Viacom into CBS and Viacom, all the television stuff, even if it was Paramount, went with CBS.
Right, right. So it's always weird how that stuff works out. But
yeah. Do we want to talk about the Cheers extended universe?
Oh.
We touched briefly on it with Cliff.
Yeah, sure.
There were crossovers besides Frasier and Tortelli's, which are spinoffs, Wings, Saint Elsewhere. A lot of the cast shows up on The Simpsons as themselves.
Yeah.
They do a spoof of the title sequence from Cheers for Flaming Moe's.
Yep. I love that episode.
Scrubs has an episode called My Life in Four Cameras. Fear of Flying is the Simpsons episode with the majority of the principal cast.
Yeah.
Adventure Time has an episode called Simon and Marcy. The 2012 comedy film Ted has a Cheers section in it.
Mm-hmm.
The video game Dragon Age 2 has a Cheers area.
Wait a minute. I played that game. I missed that. Really? That's amazing.
I don't know the details on that, but you can go into Cheers or a Cheers like place in Dragon Age 2.
That's so good. I'm guessing characters have names that are similar to all of that. Yeah, look at this. Dragon Age 2 Cheers. There's all kinds of Easter eggs.
In an episode of Becker, which Ted Danson, that was his next role after playing Sam Malone, he played Becker in the show Becker. Becker stops in at a bar on the way home, and the bartender is George Wendt, who played Norm.
That's awesome. I watched a little bit of Becker. I was interested in it because DS9's, I forgot her name. She played Dax. That was why she left DS9. She went to go be on Becker.
On Becker, right. Yep. I'd forgotten about that. Terry Farrell.
Terry Farrell, yeah. That was her next gig. And I went over there to see how that was. And I remember I didn't like it very much because it seemed like Sam Malone was just mean, because in my head it was still Sam Malone. And you just seem kind of cranky. Right.
Ted Danson had a hard time getting out from under Sam Malone. He has done it.
Oh, he has absolutely done it. My favorite season of Fargo is in large part is because of his role. I loved him in that. I loved him in Damages. I loved him in, The Good Place is obviously, you know, where everyone knows him.
Well, and there's that great episode of The Good Place season 2 finale where Michael, the character Ted Danson plays, puts on the flannel or the plaid shirt and tends bar while he's talking to Eleanor.
Yeah, which is such a cool thing.
Yeah.
That he's, you know, that he's embracing that show embraces it. Like, it's a truly historic, cool show that everybody should be freaking proud of.
I guess Fallout 4 is the one where there's a bar called Prost.
Well, there's one in Dragon Age 2, but the reference is short. I found it. Let's see
which is an exact replica of Cheers.
See if there's
and includes two dead bodies at the end of the bar, one wearing a mail carrier's uniform. So,
here's a line from Dragon Age 2. Here, let's see if it'll play audio.
I like this bar. Everybody here knows your name.
Yeah, so that has it too.
Okay.
It's impossible not to do it, right? Like,
right.
Go ahead.
Oh, no, I was going to say, speaking of Deep Space Nine and Terry Farrell, the character Morn, who is in almost every episode of Deep Space Nine and never has a line, he's a barfly in Quarks, is named after Norm Peterson.
Right. Yeah, no, and we were watching this for FilmSack. We did a watch-along episode of DS9 recently, and it came up, and we were like, is that guy named Morn because of Norm, and he's always at the bar?
Apparently Armin Shimerman, who played Quark, kept calling him Norm between takes, and they're like, well, let's call him something like that.
That's really good to hear. I love that. Well done, Cheers. You made a mark is what you did. Yeah, it's still visible in our modern culture, so well done.
Indelible.
Indelible indeed.
You cannot delete it.
Now, Tom Merritt is going on a bit of a vacation, and he can be gone for a couple of weeks. And as a result, in 2 weeks, we're going to be back here with our current Geek Film Festival selection of Seven Samurai, a film I have sadly never seen, though I have seen many movies that have drawn inspiration from it. I'm very excited to see it.
Star Wars.
Yeah, a little movie called Star Wars.
It's your first Kurosawa, huh?
First Kurosawa film. Always meant to. Never did. Don't know what held me back. Probably availability, which isn't as much of an excuse anymore. I just need to finally see it. And I mean, I've seen Magnificent Seven so many times, both the old one and other iterations of it, plus the TV show, that I owe it to my, you know, before I leave this mortal coil, I need to see what it was all based on.
You need and I don't know that it's high on our CG Film Fest list, but then you need to watch Hidden Fortress to understand C-3PO and R2-D2.
All right, I'm in. Hidden Fortress. I'll write that down. That's what we're doing. So we're going to we got Friends a month from now for Autopilot. Then we got Seven Samurai in 2 weeks. So between Seven Samurai and Friends, we'll have another regular old news episode. That's where we're at. Tom's out of here for a while.
Get into that subreddit between now and then, because we're going to need a lot of good stuff.
Yeah.
Frankgeek.reddit.com.
This is all true. All right. Before we go, a reminder, you can support the show and what we do by going on over to our Patreon at patreon.com/currentgeek. If you like what you hear here, it's a great way to give back, but there's also some cool things you can get in the mail digitally and otherwise over there at patreon.com/currentgeek. A monthly membership card, for example, signed by Tom and I. Real signatures and everything. Crazy. That's it, I think. Tom, anything else going on before you leave town you want to mention?
Just a reminder that the tech news never stops, and even if I'm going away, there will still be daily tech news hosted by Sarah Lane, along with a cast of thousands. And if you want to get more tech news than you can get just out on the public feed, there is quite a bit more. I had a great talk with Chris Ashley from the SMR podcast today about Amazon Ring doorbells and surveillance and what that means to people and why maybe you should be concerned and what you shouldn't be concerned about too. That's in the Patreon feed right now, patreon.com/DTNS. You can get that and all kinds of cool benefits. Sign up now.
Yeah, very nice. Go check that out. For me and for Tom, what else? What else is happening? That's it for me. I don't have anything to tell you about. I just know you got to go to the currentgeek.com website if you're looking for old episodes or anything else to do with the show. You'll find it all there. Don't forget our currentgeek.reddit.com website. That's where people submit a lot of stories. I think that's going to do it for us. Thank you all for being here. May you have a fantastic week. 2 weeks until we see you again. Until then, for me, for Tom, for all of you, we'll see you next time.
Hi, and welcome back to Legal Geek. This week, we cover a newly filed patent lawsuit against Apple regarding aspects of automatic spell checking. It seems like almost as long as we've had computer word processing software, we've had spell checking capability. As such, you may be surprised to learn that one of the most typical features of spell checking is still potentially covered by two U.S. patents, specifically the functionality of identifying spelling errors and potential corrections automatically for a user, which is done on Apple devices with the so-called red squiggly line underneath such errors. Apple was sued by a company called Sentius International on these two patents this week. The history of the case is actually pretty typical for patent disputes. Apple previously partnered with Sentius to help develop a precursor to the modern version of the red squiggly line spell check. Thus, Apple and Sentius likely had a prior business arrangement that sent some royalties or other money to Sentius for this assistance. However, at some point, Apple had further developed their software and functionality to an extent where it was believed Sentius no longer had to be paid for their contribution to the original version of the functionality. When Apple stopped paying Sentius in about 2015, that was the first step that led to the lawsuit eventually filed against Apple. Sentius has likely spent much of the past 4 years negotiating with Apple to try and renegotiate the terms of a license of their patented technology, but Apple refused to enter such a new agreement. That brings us to this week, where Sentius filed this lawsuit alleging that Apple's red squiggly line spell check infringes two of its patents. Looking over the claims in these patents, the claims in one of the patents is worded broadly to cover linking of a remote database with several computers and reviewing terms in a document to associate data stored in the remote database with the term and then provide that information to the computer. The other patent has been reissued with more specific claims covering systems for breaking down a text document into discrete pieces and using an external reference material to evaluate those discrete pieces. Both patents are expired or expiring soon, so the primary point of Sentius is to secure damages for the past infringements. Such patent cases can lead to big damage awards when dealing with very commercially successful defendants like Apple. So the leverage Sentius has here is to negotiate a favorable deal to gain some royalties or cash flow from Apple to perhaps settle this lawsuit. If the lawsuit proceeds, I expect these patents to be challenged for invalidity, as broader functionality software patents are the most ripe under current rules for validity attacks. It's hard to determine at this early stage who has the upper hand, but we will continue to monitor the case in the event that spellcheck, of all things, becomes a very expensive infringement for Apple in this case. The bottom line is, although patents only last for 20 years in most countries, sometimes companies like Apple can be surprised by how technology that seems like it's been around forever, like automatic spell check, can still be covered by pending older patents near the end of their term. As many of us have been burned by mistakes made by the allegedly smart spell check and autocorrect options on our smartphones, seeing Apple be pursued for patent infringement on that technology is perhaps an ironic, enjoyable twist of fate in the tech legal landscape. In any event, don't expect the infamous red squiggly to go away, though, as even if covered by these patents, they are expired or expiring soon. Thanks for listening. Please provide feedback and legal-themed questions or segment suggestions to me on Twitter at BuckeyeFitzy.
This show is part of the Frog Pants Network.
Frog Pants Network.
Get more shows like this at frogpants.com.